The Tea Health Show, your medical lifestyle podcast, brought to you by The Tea Clinic.
Good morning, I'm Dr. Mark. This is The Tea Health Show. And in studio today, I have an old colleague of mine. Sorry, he's not old, but he is grey. Dr. Owen Nosworthy. He's an oncologist. And he practices here in Dunkeld in Johannesburg. My producer, Simpiwe. Owen, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time out of a busy practice. No,
thanks for having me.
Today, we're going to talk about prostate cancer. I think when we hear the word cancer, we shudder. For men, when we hear prostate cancer, you know what, now things start ringing a little true. And it's far more common than what we want to believe. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you look at cancer in general, prostate cancer is probably the most common cancer in men. And you'll see that probably around the world. If we had to exclude just superficial skin cancers, then prostate cancer is probably the most common cancer in men.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always say that if we live long enough, probably every man will get prostate cancer. It's sort of the likelihood is exceptionally high that you'll get it. So it is very common.
Is it a dangerous cancer? Let's ask it that. We know that it's a common cancer.
Yeah.
Mortality wise, is it a cancer with a high mortality rate? The reading that I have done would indicate that, but in practice?
It can be. Any cancer obviously can have a high mortality rate. If you had to look at, you know, I said prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. It's not the most common cause of cancer deaths. Prostate cancer, if it's detected early, has got an exceptionally good prognosis. It can be treated exceptionally well. And even in some cases when it is detected quite late, if it is, you know, metastasized and it's a stage 4 cancer, we can still manage it and control it very, very well. So people can live with prostate cancer sometimes for many years. There are variants, however, that are, particularly if it occurs in younger men, commonly about 60 to 70% of prostate cancer will be diagnosed over the age of 65.
Yes.
But if you are younger, so the younger you are when it's diagnosed, it's very uncommon in your 40s, but if from between 40 and 60, then it tends to be a much more aggressive type of cancer.
Now, what I found disconcerting and actually very surprising is that we are starting to see prostate cancer in teenagers and guys in their 20s. Now, I take it that these cancers are also far more aggressive and far more deadly the younger they occur.
Yeah, so literally it's still exceptionally rare to find it in anybody under the age of 40, although we do find it in younger people. But the younger you are, it tends to be a significantly more aggressive cancer.
Is there any reason for that? Because I think it should be the opposite. Like, the younger you are, then you have a bit more time to kind of fight it off.
So the principle behind the way that prostate cancer develops generally is it occurs in elderly, most commonly in older men, basically almost from wear and tear. So it's almost caused by the chronicity of having exposure to testosterone. Mm-hmm. But when it develops sort of randomly in a young person, a young man's got much higher levels of testosterone, which is the fuel for mm-hmm. the prostate cancer. And we tend to find that there are much more aggressive variants. So it's a much more mutated type of cancer, which is much more aggressive.
Mm. So after your comment, I need to ask a question. So in my practice, I deal with hormone optimizing and balancing on a daily basis. And the cornerstone of what we use in men is testosterone. Mm. Now, I have done so much research on whether testosterone is safe for use in men. And initially there was conflicting information and studies. I think prior to 2014, prior to 2010, there were very few studies that were done on the safety of testosterone. And the results of those studies showed, but the results are inconclusive. And all the suggestions that they made out of these studies were investigate more. And between 2010 and 2014, there were a couple of very big studies that they've done, and subsequently even bigger studies. And all these studies have shown that testosterone in itself does not cause prostate cancer.
Yeah, no, and I think that's very important. It's a really, really important distinction to make. Testosterone is not bad. Testosterone is good. We need it. Men need it in higher levels. Even women have testosterone. So testosterone itself is not bad. And testosterone supplementation within, which you would know, within the normal physiological levels,
yes,
is good. It's healthy. It has far more benefits than any risks. And there is literally no sort of correlation between testosterone supplementing and causing cancer.
Mm.
The difference is that if you have got prostate cancer, then testosterone is the fuel for that.
Yeah.
And it hasn't caused it. It is just the fuel which then feeds the cancer.
I'm glad that you said that, because I think so many younger guys, body conscious, but they think testosterone is for muscles.
Yeah.
Which it's the last thing that it actually does after you went through puberty. That's the last role of testosterone. But they use it in such excessive doses combined with anabolic steroids that, they don't really know the risks on things like polycythemia, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, etc. And lo and behold, they don't test their prostates. They continue using testosterone, and suddenly, you take a small little ember or a candle that's lovely and giving you light, and suddenly, you're throwing it into a haystack.
That's the problem, right? I think we know testosterone's safe. We know even in people with prostate cancer who have been treated successfully with radiation or they've had surgery and it's been removed, we know we can supplement testosterone again if we need to, provided it's done safely and within the physiological levels. It's really just the abuse of any anabolic steroids or testosterone which is not safe.
We'll get to some of the other risk factors in a moment, but how does prostate cancer present? How do I know that, oh my God, something is wrong, I need to get to my urologist for some kind of intervention?
And so I think that's the problem, is that in a large number of cases, it doesn't present. By the time you're aware that you've got prostate cancer, it may be that it's already too late or it's advanced. Prostate is basically a little gland that sits below at the base of the bladder, and it's responsible, as you know, for basically lubricating the semen to allow ejaculation. And what we find is that all men, as we get older, most commonly will get prostatic enlargement. It's called BPH, benign prostatic enlargement, which is a benign process, but your prostate swells. And commonly then you start to find that you struggle to pass urine and that sort of stuff. Prostate cancer generally will not present, or not generally, but in a large number of cases, does not present with an enlarged prostate. So it'll often start with a little lump on the inside of the prostate gland, as opposed to sort of a huge big lump on the outside, which is causing pressure. And so often it can be missed or even undiagnosed until it's too advanced. And so that's why there are screening guidelines.
My hand came back before some periods.
We're back to med school.
On that, the screening that we used to do for prostate cancer was, okay, lie on your side, take a deep breath, and don't pinch.
So, is that it?
No. I can tell you, I hate doing prostate exams for one reason. The first time I did that, I pushed my finger through the glove.
Oh, no.
It was also one of the last times that I did a prostate exam on my patients. It's far easier to refer them for a sonar. But there's the digital rectal examinations, but that has fallen completely out of favor now.
Yeah.
You cannot remember what you felt a year ago. And as you just said, it's a very insensitive thing. You depend on your finger.
Exactly, yeah.
If something is on the inside, you're not going to feel it. And then we get to prostate-specific antigen. Now, Owen, what I find confusing is in the literature, they're talking about inclusivity and access to medical treatment, and they are recommending that we do not screen for prostate cancer with PSAs as often as I personally think we should. Now, PSA, prostate-specific antigen, do you want to talk a little bit more about that for us before we carry on?
So PSA is a test which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of. It just gets bandied around. And it is a very useful test. But basically what it is it's a little molecule or a little protein which occurs in all of the prostate cells. So whether it's cancerous or benign or normal prostate cells, it's a little protein which generally gets released predominantly into the semen. But a small percentage of it gets released into the bloodstream, and it's associated. We talk about cancer markers in general. It's associated with when the prostate is busy regenerating itself. Sometimes some of the older cells will die, and it releases this PSA, this antigen, this little protein into the bloodstream. And if the cancer, if you do have cancer and it's growing rapidly, then you'll have a higher cell death, and so you have a higher release of this PSA, this antigen, this protein. It is a very useful tool, but it is not foolproof. No blood test, unfortunately, ever is perfect. And so when we're talking about screening, you're saying the digital rectal exam has tended to fall away, and it has, because it's a very, unless you're doing, as a urologist, for example, doing 10 a day, maybe, your average doctor's not going to know. They're not going to be experienced in doing it. And so it is much less reliable. Whereas your PSA is a simple blood test, which you can do. The guidelines will change regularly, unfortunately. Yeah. And at the moment, the guidelines have tended to say don't need to do it as frequently, once maybe every 2 years. But, my feeling is that every man over 50 should at least do it once a year. It is a useful tool. But we don't take it in isolation.
That's the important thing. In my practice, I actually start with PSA screening at a younger age. I start the moment I start seeing the patient. If you're over the age of 35 and you present to me in my practice for hormone balancing or optimization, it's a standard.
And I think
that's something that I always do. The reason I do that is the following. We know that 8% of men with a PSA below 1 will have prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Now, a normal PSA is somewhere between 0 and 4. So if it's below 1 and 8% of men have cancer, you're missing a great deal. When it comes to 1 to 4, it goes up as high as 25%, am I correct? And the moment that it's above, I think, 5, it's 10, sorry. So
the minute it's above 10,
50% of men will have.
50%
So PSA, in my opinion, is not a sensitive screening test because you might miss stuff. But I find that serial PSA measurements, doing them on a regular basis, will show us if there's any change. And now, okay, I'm starting to be suspicious about something happening. PSA doesn't only elevate in cancer, though.
No, it
doesn't. So what are some of the other conditions that might cause elevated PSA?
So, cancer is probably the least common reason for your PSA to be elevated. When we're talking about an elevated PSA, and I agree with you 100%, we should never take one sample as gospel. We should always repeat it and see the result. But there are many reasons for a PSA to be elevated. Probably the most common reason is if it's very marginally elevated is in elderly men who have got a swollen prostate.
Okay, so that's the BPH.
It's marginally elevated. You've got a bigger prostate. It's a little bit squished inside its little capsule, and so it's going to release more of this enzyme. The digital rectal exam, classically, you know, when you go
if
to
you
your doctor,
stimulate if the prostate,
stimulating the prostate, and the same goes for any sexual activity where you're stimulating the prostate, the same thing will happen. So anything which puts pressure on the prostate gland is going to get a moderate rise in your PSA. Another very common reason for it is something called prostatitis, which is an infection which occurs in the prostate gland. Again, very common in older men. More
and
associated
it can
with,
be subclinical.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily and the very first thing that a urologist will do if somebody's got a marginally elevated PSA between 4 and 10 will be to treat them with antibiotics before going and sticking a needle in or doing something invasive. You don't have to have pain. You don't have to have blood in your urine to have a prostatitis. So it can be, as you say, subclinical. So there are many reasons. Any traumatic injury. Weirdly enough, they say that people that ride bikes are more
I was just going to ask
you know, there's certain recommendations, although most of us don't necessarily specify to the patient not to do some of these things prior to testing their PSA. There are certain things they recommend not doing for at least 1 to 2 days prior to.
Well, I know that ejaculating
and ejaculation is one of them. Yes,
one.
Yeah. So if we're wanting to be clinical and absolutely precise, then you should not ride a bike, not have any stimulation of the prostate gland, no ejaculation within 48 hours, and then we can have possibly a very very sort of reliable more sensitive test. But if you do the test and the PSA is moderately elevated, a safe bet would be to repeat it a month later or 2 months later and see. And then we do what we call the trend. Some studies call it the PSA velocity. And basically, if it is, you're doing a couple of PSA tests and it is rising, you want to see how rapidly it's rising over a period of a few months prior to doing anything too invasive.
Okay. I know that some of the urology associations have now said that gold standard for screening for prostate cancer is an MRI. Would you agree with that? It's not viable South Africa or in Africa for
we
that
can't,
matter.
We can't say that it's a gold standard for screening. I think it could be a gold standard to confirm if you've got a very high suspicion. But, I mean, you know, the ways that you can check if somebody's got a problem with their prostate is you can do the PSA. But then ideally you do need to sort of confirm if there's a problem with some form of imaging. Whether that's
an ultrasound.
An ultrasound. And generally it's a transrectal ultrasound, which,
yeah, which
is invasive.
Far less invasive than someone's finger up your bum.
Oh, no, absolutely. I totally agree. But it's still invasive, but probably more cost efficient, if you can put it that way. But it needs to be done by somebody that knows what they're doing. But an MRI is an exceptionally expensive tool as a screening. You know, screening means that we're needing to basically the entire male population is needing to have this test done, and it's just not viable anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So I think if you've got a high index of suspicion from a PSA test or anything else, you then can follow that up with imaging, whether it's an ultrasound or an MRI.
Okay. So before we take a look at some of the presenting signs and symptoms, if you do have cancer, Owen, is there a difference in population groups, ethnicities? We know that the risk of developing prostate cancer increase with age, but what are some of the other risk factors?
So some of the other risk factors, and, you know, we unfortunately, again, when we're dealing in South Africa, we a lot of the time we extrapolate from the US data and from overseas data. But what is quite worrying and concerning is that one of the big risk factors taken from a large study in America is that being African-American and by extrapolation being African have a much higher risk of developing prostate cancer than being white, Caucasian. Weirdly enough, sort of Latinos, Mexicans have a lower, a much lower risk than the white population, who obviously have a lower risk than the black population. So race does play a role, and we don't know why. There hasn't been enough investigations done into it. And in South Africa, we haven't got that data. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our cancer registry is not as up to date as it should be, and we don't have as much data as we should have. But it is a huge risk, which is why we should be screening. You know, should have a much higher index of screening.
And
other risk factors. Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
I think the population group with the highest risk is the population group that doesn't screen.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately the historically the problem, and still currently the problem is that the biggest risk group are not being, or don't have access to screening the way that they should. You know, the PSA is a very simple test. It's a cheap test, but it's not freely available in the government setting, if you can put it that way. And doesn't matter if it's 60 Rand or 100 Rand, your average person in the population may not be able to afford that test, and it should be provided the same way that a pap smear is a sort of a freely available test, although probably not as freely available as we'd like. So there's a huge sort of need for screening tools.
Other risk factors. Genetics, does it play a role?
So absolutely. So we know that, and again, there's only really one, well, maybe two specific genetic sort of risks that we know. And that's, there's a specific genetic sort of abnormality or mutation that we can test for, something called BRCA.
So this is the same one as that we do for women with breast cancer.
Most commonly found in women with breast cancer, although it is still very rare. It's only about 5% of women with breast cancer. But that BRCA mutation is associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, even in men, if you've got that, and ovarian cancer and breast cancer. We know that a percentage of men with prostate cancer have been tested, and about 20% of them will have the BRCA mutation. It can be hereditary. So that is a hereditary risk.
If your father
is tested and he's got the BRCA mutation, then ideally you should go for counseling, both sons and daughters, all your children and siblings.
Okay. Same with mother. If mother has a BRCA gene.
So if the mother has a BRCA gene, then all children should be tested as well.
Okay. So is there a familial trait in it? If my brother and my father and my grandfather had prostate cancer, do I have an increased risk?
Absolutely. So you know, as I say, BRCA is an incredibly high risk, and we can test for it. But the vast majority of hereditary cancers are not going to have a genetic abnormality we can test for. But if your father has had prostate cancer, or your brother has had prostate cancer, then you have, or it's in the family, your grandfather, then you have a statistically significantly higher risk. Weirdly enough, if your brother has prostate cancer, you have a 50% higher chance of getting prostate cancer, whereas if your father has prostate cancer, it's roughly in the region of about 20 to 30% chance. So
that's strange.
It is strange. Nobody's
you know
really
what? Actually, call up your siblings.
So, you know, the basic thing is that all men should be tested. If your relative, your close relative, your grandfather, father, or brother gets prostate cancer, then you need to go and be screened, and be screened regularly.
So the only other cancer that I always recommend that for is colon cancer. Is it basically the same situation? All cancers, is it that if I have a first-line family member with cancer, you know what, my risk of having cancer is higher, or is it an environmental thing?
So it absolutely is with a large proportion of cancers. Now, there are, and I can't say all cancers. So, you know, if we look at the common cancers, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, even melanoma, skin cancers, we know that if your close relative has it, you have a higher risk. The statistics vary slightly depending upon which cancer it is, but there are rare cancers. You know, there are weird bone cancers and weird muscle cancers, for example, that just happen de novo, and you know your risk of it being hereditary is zero.
So help me if I'm wrong. This was late last night. I was exhausted, so I can't remember a lot. In my reading, I saw that there's a association between a patient who was diagnosed with prostate cancer and developing melanoma.
So there's not necessarily. I mean, yes, let me put it that way. The easy answer is yes. The reason for that is particularly prostate cancer and melanoma are two very common cancers. There's currently no known genetic link between them.
Okay.
Melanoma, and particularly in the parts of the world where it's common, Africa, Australia, the sort of lower parts of America, it's associated with sun exposure. Most of us, and particularly at our age now, and our parents have had significant sun exposure when we were young. We did not use sunscreen. And associated with that, we're all heading into the age now where we're most likely going to get prostate cancer at some point. So that's the link. There's no genetic tie yet. And there may be, but there's not enough information on that yet.
Owen, other risk factors, environmental factors.
So other risk factors are few and far between when it comes to prostate cancer.
Weird smoking? Enough,
so smoking, I have to say yes, because smoking is bad. But it's bad for all cancers. But weirdly enough, they've done a couple of conflicting studies. Initially, obviously, we've always said smoking will cause any cancer. But a number of studies have shown conflicting data saying that smoking doesn't necessarily increase your risk of prostate cancer. The belief, however, is that if you've got prostate cancer and you smoke, you're going to have a higher a risk or a worse prognosis.
Yes, I read that.
You know, again, I would still say that, yes, but the data is quite conflicting, actually.
Obesity?
Obesity, again, for a number of years, there were studies that showed that you had a higher risk of getting prostate cancer with obesity. Now the data tends to show that it's not really that you've got a higher risk, but exactly the same as with smoking, is that if you're obese, you've got a worse prognosis if you get prostate cancer.
Okay.
So it's generally, we think, to do with fitness. You know, the fitter you are, and we're not talking marathon runners, just the healthier you are, the better your body's ability to fight cancer. We've all got cancer occurring in our body every single day on a molecular level, but our immune systems have the ability to deal with it. The less healthy you are, the weaker your immune system, and the more likely you're one of those cancer cells are to be able to evade the immune system.
Okay. Owen, diagnosis of cancer. For me, no, actually, let's circle back a little bit. Warning signs. You mentioned earlier blood in the urine, blood in the semen, pelvic discomfort pain in the pelvic area.
You know, generally warning signs, again, often a large percent of people will be asymptomatic when they're diagnosed. But warning signs would be blood in the urine or blood in the semen.
Is it because the cancer has already infiltrated the bladder?
So it can be one of two things. So blood in the urine, most likely, yes. Or what could have happened is if the cancer has, because often what the cancer will do in this little confined prostate gland is instead of growing outside.
Oh, it will erode through the urethra.
Inside and it can sort of irritate the urethra and you can have some blood. More commonly, though, we'll find blood in the semen.
With that, is it because of blood that collects in the seminal vesicles?
Yeah.
And I know that when it spreads to the seminal vesicles, it's also a far, far worse prognosis when it's already there.
Yeah, so that just means that it has sort of, it's extended further. But it's basically, you know, cancer, when it develops, it's a very fragile tissue, although it can be so harmful and invasive. If you've got a cancer on your skin and you touch it, it'll bleed easily. It's a very fragile tissue. And so when you are ejaculating, basically there are some muscles around that prostate gland which are, or within it even, which are basically forcing and moving the seminal fluid. And so what will happen is you will have a little blood vessel in the cancer which pops and releases a bit of blood. Or the cancer may very well have invaded a blood vessel. So there are many reasons for it. But you're not generally not going to have sort of a massive hemorrhage. It's just going to be some blood in the semen, the seminal fluid. And that's a worry. You know, again, the most common reason for that is prostatitis, an infection. But it is a warning sign and it needs to be investigated. You know, other presenting signs often can be unexplained weight loss, you know, and that can be a sign of any cancer, but it needs to be investigated. Discomfort in the, particularly in the pelvic area, or pain in the bones. Cancer, prostate cancer preferentially will spread into your bones, and sometimes very early before it's even sort of extended outside of the prostate gland itself. We don't know why, but probably one of the most common presenting features of prostate cancer is pain in the bones, and the cancer's already spread into your bones.
So does that spread happen through lymphatic drainage, or is it through?
So it's generally through vascular. So, you know, the whole prostate gland is a very vascular organism. Okay. With lots of blood vessels in it, mm-hmm. supplying all the nutrients to be able to keep your semen nice and fluid and working well. But as the cancer invades and it grows through one of those tiny little blood vessels, all it needs is to release one little cancer cell floating off into the bloodstream, and it's now spread.
Specific bones that are usually the spine?
Most commonly is the spine and the pelvic bones.
Okay.
It has something to do with the blood supply and the blood flow from the prostate gland through the body, but we don't necessarily know exactly why it preferentially goes to bones and not to other organs, for example, early.
So we know with benign prostatic hypertrophy, just enlargement of a prostate, there's obstruction, basically, yeah. mild obstruction of the urethra. Yeah. So would cancer sometimes cause the same change in stream velocity and flow?
And again, it all depends on where it's starting and the position of where it's developed. It absolutely can. If it's starting on the inside of this sort of, they call it a walnut shape, although we don't really know much about walnuts in Africa. But inside this little organ, if the cancer starts internally right in the middle, then as it's growing, it will put some pressure and obstruction on the urethra. But if it's starting outside, round on the external part of it, then you're not going to necessarily have any obstructive symptoms.
Okay. Sims?
Sure.
Are you suddenly glad that you're not a man?
Oh, I've always been glad. Oh.
No, I have to be honest. I think, you know what, we have it a little bit easier, but at least we don't have to sit down to pee all the time.
we have our benefits.
I'm not sure about that.
Owen, diagnosis. Yeah. So we have a problem. My PSA is maybe elevated. I'm having urinary symptoms. I go to the urologist. We do a blood test. PSA is a little bit elevated. Now what? Do we wait and repeat? Or depending on the level of the PSA and the physical examination,
Once you've got a high index of suspicion, whether that is, you know, if you've got one PSA test that is 100, that is exceptionally
or
high.
Above 10.
Even above 10, you know. But if you've got one test which is exceptionally high, or you've got serial tests where you can see that PSA is rising, or you've got some symptom which is concerning to the doctor, the next thing that they would do, and commonly it would be the urologist, would be wanting to do what we call imaging. So we're wanting to now have a look at the prostate. And as we mentioned earlier, that can be one of two things. It can be an ultrasound. Most commonly, it would be a transrectal. So it's a tiny little probe which they push into the rectum, and they can then have a look very carefully at the prostate and have a look to see whether it should be on pictures, and this would be the same on the MRI, a very homogeneous picture. And what they look for is whether there are patchiness in any of the area of the prostate which is not in keeping with with the normal homogeneity of this tissue,
mm.
and that would then be concerning. So an MRI is exactly the same. It is more sensitive, without a doubt. So if you've got a concern, you've got a very high index of suspicion, you've done a rectal ultrasound, you're still not sure, an MRI would be able to tell you whether there's something concerning there. Then what would happen is the urologist would want to do a biopsy. So again, this now gets done. It does get done in the hospital. Generally, it's a day procedure. You do have an anesthetic, although you often are awake, but they give you a local anesthetic. And the urologist then, with the ultrasound, they'll have a look at where the prostate gland is, and they'll ideally have an idea of where the concerning areas are.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will do, through the rectum again, they'll do what's called a transrectal biopsy. So it's a very small needle that goes through the wall of the rectum into the prostate gland, and they take multiple biopsies from all different parts of the prostate gland. Sometimes even if we don't have a concerning little area in the prostate gland, but we've got a very high index of suspicion, they'll still do blind biopsies of all the different areas. They label them carefully so that they know where the biopsy comes from, and that goes to the laboratory. And the laboratory then makes the diagnosis of prostate cancer or a pre-invasive type of malignancy or benign normal tissue. And so the diagnosis is confirmed and made specifically from the biopsy with the pathologists. If you are confirmed and you are, then it is confirmed to be prostate cancer, then there's certain features that we look at as to how aggressive it is. And then we also do what we call staging so that we can have a look to see whether it has spread anywhere.
Okay. So, you know what? He's reading my mind because I'm going to ask you about staging. Gleason, we still use the Gleason scale. Hey.
Yeah.
Okay. What's that?
So Owen's going to explain it. It's bloody complicated. I still find it difficult to understand.
So Gleason scale is basically it's done on the pathology. So the pathologists will have a look and they'll diagnose that it is cancerous. And basically they'll give it consists of two scores.
Mm-hmm.
It's very technical, but it's based on how aggressive the cancer looks. How many when they're having a look at it, how many cancer cells are in the process of dividing at the time when the biopsy was done, and they can have a look at basically how aggressive it is.
Okay.
It consists of, as I said, two scores, which they then add together. And if you've got a Gleason score of 6 or above,
you have cancer.
You've got cancer, and the higher it is, the more aggressive it is.
Oh.
Basically. Sure. And, you know, the more aggressive a cancer is, the higher the Gleason score, the higher the risk that it could spread early. Maybe we need to be more aggressive in terms of our treatments.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a confirmed prostate cancer, confirmed it's cancerous, but mm-hmm. your Gleason score is 4, then in a lot of those cases, we can say, look, we've got, and to some people it's very disconcerting, but to others it's not. We say, you've got a very benign, low-grade cancer. And the studies will tell us that it will probably burn out on its own and we don't need to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years, we went from diagnosing cancer, being very aggressive, major surgeries, and they found that there was actually an over-treatment of some people with prostate cancer.
Absolutely.
And that's where this sort of approach has now come in to be able to decide, look, you've got a very low-grade, low-risk cancer. Do we want to put you through major surgery or radiation, which could leave you impotent and have all sorts of long-term complications, or can we watch and wait? Repeat your PSA once a year or once every 6 months for the next 10 years and we find that it actually goes away.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that you say that. When we look at biopsies, cadaver biopsies,
mm-hmm.
the majority of guys older than 65, 70, 80 will have some form of cancer. So they will die with cancer, not because of cancer.
Okay.
And, prostate cancer is one of those.
That I said, you know, if we live long enough, many, many years ago when they did look at it, they did sort of autopsies on a whole number of sort of 80-plus-year-old men, and they found that every single one of them had prostate cancer.
Hmm.
They didn't know about it. It would not have killed them. As you say, they died with it, but it's just there's a very high chance that everybody will have it at some point, but not everybody is going to present with cancer, not everybody needs treatment.
Okay. So, Owen, I think we've covered most. I think what most people will know is I have a diagnosis of prostate cancer. What now?
Okay, so you've got the diagnosis. Now, the first thing, and this is really, really important, is to be comfortable with your doctor. Just because...
Is this your urologist or an oncologist?
Anybody. So, you know, what I always say is, and the vast majority of people with prostate cancer will be diagnosed by a urologist, and that is their specialty, and they are exceptionally good at doing this and managing the cancer.
So they do the treatment?
So it's most commonly the urologists will, because, you know, when we're looking at the treatment for prostate cancer, it is... If it is still contained and localized, the treatment is either surgery. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they use a robot surgery, so it's a very sort of minimally invasive surgery. Or it's doing radiation and what we call brachytherapy, where, the urologist, together with an oncologist, put little radioactive pellets into the prostate gland and kill it. So the urologists are very involved in treating the cancer.
Okay.
Generally, the time that a person with prostate cancer gets to somebody like myself, a medical oncologist, is if the cancer has spread and they may need other therapies, special hormone blockades or chemotherapies and that.
Okay. So I wanted to ask complications of treatment for prostate cancer. Let's start with the least invasive brachytherapy.
Okay, so when it comes to the complications of treatment, and we'll talk about the complications of localized treatment first, which is the cancer hasn't spread, we're going to cure you, that's the plan. We've basically got two options then in terms of treatment. The one is brachytherapy, which is, as we said, it involves very similar to the biopsy, is going to theater, and the urologist and usually the radiation oncologist will plan very carefully. They have a 3D version from the CT scan and the MRI of the prostate gland, and they plan in advance with computer software to be able to place these little radiation pellets throughout the entire prostate gland. It can vary anywhere from 60 to 180 little pellets, sometimes more. And they make sure with the computer simulation that the entire prostate gland is covered so that the whole gland is radiated. But we know that radiation, unfortunately, it does have side effects, and we know that by killing that entire or radiating the entire prostate gland, you can have some fallout from the tissues around it. Mm. The procedure itself can have complications. They're sticking multiple needles into you, 180 in some cases.
That's a lot.
So you can have pain afterwards. You can have bleeding, blood in your urine, again, blood in the semen. You can have... sort of generally it's more temporary, but you can have a bit of impotence, so difficulty with maintaining an erection. Usually that's more short-term, temporary.
I find it to be the other way around. I find in my practice, guys who had prostate cancer start noticing a decline in erectile functioning a couple of months after the procedure.
No, sure. So we're talking about what I was sort of talking about was the acute immediate trauma.
Okay.
You know, when they're putting those.
Yeah, I'm not going to get hard if it's.
You're not going to get hard. There's lots of trauma around that, and the nerves surrounding the prostate gland are the ones that are responsible for erection, and so there's just a lot of acute trauma for the first sort of 48 hours to a week. But there are also long-term complications or side effects from brachytherapy. It is the gold standard. It is a fantastic treatment. But what we find is long-term, you can get, firstly, because we're not removing the entire prostate gland, there's a risk that they missed a little section, and so the cancer can come back again. Mm-hmm. What happens is that radiation can sometimes, and this can be... A couple of years later, you can get what's called a radiation proctitis. So that's your rectum, and the radiation has slowly irritated the rectum, and so you can get diarrhea, quite bad diarrhea, sometimes bloody diarrhea. It's not common.
Sounds awful.
You're looking horrified, but it can happen, and that often then will require intensive management to deal with that. You can then also long-term, slowly over time, get declining erectile function. Mm. It's much lower risk than with surgery, but it does still happen.
Often, and I find it is far more treatable.
Yeah.
when I have patients with brachytherapy with erectile dysfunction, I treat them with platelet-rich plasma. Yeah.
So it's not, you know, if we go to surgery, for example, where you are now, in the old days, 10 years ago, the what we call a radical prostatectomy was a surgeon's big hands going into this tiny little space, removing the prostate gland, and so the damage was irreparable. The nerves were cut. You were guaranteed of erectile dysfunction, and the nerves were cut. They were damaged and removed.
Yeah.
And so that's not repairable at all. Nowadays, with this Da Vinci robotic surgery, it is significantly less invasive, but there is still a risk. They're cutting. And so there's a significantly higher risk of nerve damage and permanent nerve damage, which is then much more difficult to treat.
I think, you know, it, we can still get past the erectile dysfunction. That we can treat with implants and stuff like that. But when it comes to the urinary incontinence that sometimes happen, that not only is embarrassing, you know, I have to wear a pad to walk around in public. I don't really have full control over my bladder. That sometimes I find is one of the worst side effects.
It's a very real, very big side effect, and it occurs in both circumstances. You know, the prostate gland, as I said, sits at the base of your bladder, and it almost acts as a little bit of a support and a valve almost to help you control it. It assists the muscles that we use to control our bladder. If we're radiating it slowly over time, that prostate tissue just slowly shrivels up into a little bit of scar tissue, and so that support's gone. If you have surgery, it's removed, and so that support's gone. And so then you have got significant problems in terms of bladder control. And in some cases, it's unmanageable. In other cases, they can try and put in implants. There are all sorts of little electrical implants they can put in now at the base of the bladder to try and stimulate the muscles to work better. But it's very, very difficult to manage. I agree with you.
Okay.
And it's embarrassing, you know, for anybody. That's a very, very similar to a woman who's, you know, pelvis is, their pelvic floors drop. Yeah.
Post-hysterectomy. Yeah. We're dealing with that a lot. It's a huge stress problem. Incontinence and urinary incontinence. Owen, more invasive therapy, your radical prostatectomies. It really depends on the stage of the cancer, whether we go and do a radical prostatectomy or total prostatectomy versus brachytherapy, not really.
So when it comes to, you know, they've really done extensive studies now, and brachytherapy and surgery have always come out with basically identical long-term outcomes. For many years, when a radical prostatectomy, which is going and removing the prostate gland and taking the lymph nodes out around it, it was an incredibly invasive procedure. You were in hospital for sometimes up to 2 weeks with a catheter in. So the trend shifted towards brachytherapy then. It was significantly less invasive. It's one day in hospital, you go home, you have a week of discomfort, and then you know you're fine. With the invention of this now micro-robotic surgery, the pendulum has shifted a little bit again towards the middle, where it becomes the patient's choice. It's a patient's choice, and that's where I go back to what I said earlier, is that the patient should always be comfortable with their doctor.
Yeah.
And the doctor should be open and discussing all options with them. Mm-hmm. And then a patient should always get a second opinion.
Okay. That was going to be my question. How do I, as the patient, open this discussion with my urologist? He prefers surgery, but my brother had surgery. It was a big fuck up. How do I do that? Go for a second opinion to someone else?
Yeah, and it's a very intimidating thing. You know, going to a doctor shouldn't be, but it is. I mean, I remember when I was young, you know, the doctor was God. What he said happened, and that shouldn't be the case anymore. But that often is still the impression. And, you know, if you're sitting in front of that doctor and he's told you you've got cancer and he wants to operate tomorrow, your first instinct is to say, God, yes, get it out of me. Nothing should ever be that forced, and you should never be put into that position. Go home, think about it, then get a second opinion. If you've seen a urologist, come and see an oncologist to get a sort of a a different opinion. If you've been diagnosed by an oncologist, go and see a urologist to get a second opinion.
Okay.
So that you're getting a balanced opinion. Then you can make an informed decision based on what's best for you.
Yeah. I love what you say. I always tell my patients, my main job is to give you all the information that you need to make an informed decision.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between compliance and adherence.
Yeah.
I believe patients should adhere. In other words, they are part of a decision-making process. Yeah. Adam, let's say this cancer has spread. What are the options? Radiation therapy, chemotherapy?
So the options are varied and very successful. So, you know, again, I think prostate cancer, which has spread, still has a significantly better prognosis than a lot of other cancers which have spread. We may not be able to cure it, but we can treat it for many years, sometimes decades. The treatment involves basically, firstly, the extent of where the cancer has spread, how aggressive it is. The mainstay of treatment has basically traditionally always involved, as we mentioned earlier, testosterone fuels the cancer. So the mainstay of treatment has always involved taking away the testosterone.
So this is basically the oracheotomy, chemical oracheotomy, basically.
So many years ago, the first line of treatment was going and doing what's called an orchidectomy, which is removing the testicles. Yeah, so it's a castration, yeah. It's a very successful treatment, but obviously it's a very emotionally scarring treatment. So what happens now is we've got medications which do a similar thing. So it's called a medical castration, where we're not having to go and remove your testicles because that is just a very dehumanizing act.
They're just going to shrink in
any
case.
And well, yeah, but it's just an unthinkable thing for many men. And so we use medications which just switch the testicles off, stop them from working, and stop them from producing testosterone. And we'll combine that in some cases with medications which help to just block any circulating testosterone so that the cancer doesn't get its feed.
You use an androgen blocker.
Yeah.
But do you also switch off the follicle-stimulating luteinizing hormone axis?
Yeah. So basically, we if we're wanting to treat somebody properly and aggressively, which is what we should do, at least at the start, and I'll speak to you about cycling the therapy on and off in a little bit. We want to start aggressively and we want to switch off both processes. So we use what's called a GnRH agonist, which basically switches off the hormones coming from the brain, telling the testicles to produce testosterone. So it stops that process. It's like turning a light switch off.
And but that will have an effect on other hormone systems as well.
So no, it doesn't. It works specifically on the testosterone. So,
it FSH. Doesn't
FSH.
And LH.
And LH.
More than FSH. Yeah. Okay.
And we use a very similar thing in women who have breast cancer at an early age. So, we will use the androgen blockers to go and block any testosterone which may be circulating. You know, we do have accessory pathways where sometimes testosterone gets produced in muscles or fat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use those to go and just make sure that we're blocking everything we can. If the cancer has spread into somebody's bones, we use a medication called a bisphosphonate, which it's not a chem cancer treatment in any way, but it helps to strengthen the bones because when cancer's in the bones,
it's a very scary thing. We usually use it for osteoporosis.
Yeah, so it was developed for osteoporosis. And cancer in the bones, basically, I always say to my patients, nobody dies from cancer in the bones, but you have complications. You have pain and you can have fractures because your bones become very crumbly, very similar to osteoporosis. So they found that these medicines, which were developed for osteoporosis, have a significant benefit in reducing the complications of cancer in the bones. They strengthen the bones, take away the pain, make sure you don't have fractures.
Okay.
We use this combination. Once we've managed to get the cancer under control, whether that's, and in some cases with more aggressive cancers, we use chemotherapy as well, then what we do is they've shown that a very successful strategy, and in the vast majority of people, the PSA is elevated. If we manage to get it down to undetectable levels, you can then cycle on and off. So you can have 3 months on the androgen blockade, 3 months off, 3 months on, 6 months on, 6 months off. Because having your hormones taken away is not a nice thing. If it's what we have to do, it's what we have to do to keep you alive.
Yeah.
But it's not a pleasant thing. Your quality of life significantly deteriorates. And so they've shown that if we can cycle it on and off, you can have a significantly better quality of life without compromising our chronic management of this cancer.
Okay. Oh, and that's fascinating. Simpiwe is giving me the lasso. There's so much that I still want to ask you, but you know what? Suffice to say, if we give a brief overview of what we've spoken about today, prostate cancer is a very common cancer amongst men, but it's a treatable cancer as long as we diagnose it early.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are some signs that you can look out for, but the majority of them don't present with any signs. And, you know, but that's what makes it scary. Serial treatment or serial screening with PSA, if it's available to you, inequality does play a role. We don't have it freely available in our government institutions. But if you are in private healthcare, it's something that you should start doing. I would say from at least the age of 45, maybe bit earlier.
The guidelines will say 45. If I had to say personally, at least from the age of 40.
Yeah. Do it yearly.
And you should do it every year. Most of the medical aids will give you, now you get your discovery points and your whatever. It's encouraged. It should be done once a year. It's non-invasive. It's just a simple blood test. But it can save your life and it can save you long-term harm from potential treatments. Okay.
Some of the big risk factors is genetic predisposition. So if anyone in your family, direct family, had breast cancer, ovarian cancer, or prostate cancer, you are at a higher risk, yeah. So you should start screening earlier.
Start screening earlier, yeah.
And you know what? Talk about this. Find a practitioner that you can trust, that you know will give you an honest opinion. Don't be scared to go for a second opinion. You don't have to go to your urologist necessarily. We can visit someone like you, an oncologist.
Absolutely.
Okay. Owen, I think there's a lot of people that will be listening to the show, a lot of people with questions. Your practice is the Nosworthy Oncology Center Nosworthy here Oncology in Dunkeld, Johannesburg.
Kentrode in Dunkeld.
Can you give us the office number if someone wants to contact you?
Yes, 011-482-3593.
Okay. You know what? You can see that we're getting old. We have to think about our phone numbers. If you want to know anything about prostate cancer or hormone optimization or the risk thereof, you can also call us at the T Clinic on 010-824-1393. If you've missed Dr. Nosworthy's number, you will be able to get it from my practice as well. Owen, I want to thank you for taking your time. You and I have discussed doing regular podcasts on other cancers. I think for women, breast cancer, cervical cancer, absolutely, skin cancer, etc., is definitely something that we need to address at some point. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you for your insights.
I really appreciate the opportunity just to be able to provide the information.
Thank you so much. Next week, I will be talking to Dr. Pulile Mpofu, and we're going to talk about pigmentation and the management of pigmentation. Until next week, we wish you all the best in health.
That was the Tea Health Show, empowering you with knowledge. Download all previous episodes on your favorite podcast platform. The Tea Health Show is brought to you by Tea Clinic.